Welcome to Back to the Sources, a podcast for those looking for a window into the life of Concordia Seminary and our library, whether you are a theologian, pastor, or prospective student. Each episode explores deep theological questions, profound insights, and topics of interest, brought to you by both professors and students alike. We hope that these conversations enrich your faith, academic, and professional development by connecting you to our rich resources. Back to the Sources is brought to you by the Hasse Library on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The Hasse Library, inspiring theological discovery.
All right. My name is Kendall Davis. I am an STM student here, and I have with me today
Ben Vanderhyde, soon to be full-time STM student as well.
So today, what we're going to do for the podcast is just talk through the process of working with an exegetical study and specifically reading a text, because I think that what happens a lot of times is people have to study a text from the scriptures, whether say like for a sermon or a Bible study or whatever, and they find that they don't know where to start, or there's so much, or like it just seems so clear. Why bother studying it? The text is so clear already. And so I think it's helpful to model and practice going through a text and then showing like, these are the sorts of questions that you can ask about the text. Kind of both kind of small things, kind of verse by verse level things, and also more big picture questions, so that then this guides your research, so that you don't just kind of pick up a bunch of random commentaries off the shelf and then just kind of regurgitate what they say randomly, but that you actually have questions that you want to seek out answers to, and then you find answers to them. And that guides your research, so you're not just kind of regurgitating whatever your favorite commentary says. So that's kind of what we're doing today, Ben.
Yeah, so like when I walk into the library, this is the idea. I have a direction.
Yes.
I'm not just wandering about aimless.
Yeah, you don't just kind of search for Luke and then see what pops up. Yeah, so give us a direction, because it is, there's so many angles that you can take and directions you can go. And I think it gets really overwhelming. Does that make sense?
Sounds good.
All right. So I will go ahead and read our text for today. We're going to take a look at Matthew chapter 21, starting at verse 33. We'll go all the way to the end of the chapter, verse 46. So that's Matthew chapter 21, starting at verse 33, if you want to follow along at home. And I'll go ahead and read through this in English. All right. So just context, Jesus is now in Jerusalem, and he is going through this kind of trilogy of parables. So right before, he had this parable about the two sons, which was the obedient son. And then he tells the parable of the tenants and the vineyard. And then he'll go on to do the parable of the wedding feast. So he's talking with the crowds on the Temple Mount, but especially the Pharisees, the Sadducees, etc. So that's where we're at. So Matthew 21, verse 33, Jesus said, "Hear another parable. There was a master of a house who planted a vineyard and put a fence around it and dug a wine press in it and built a tower and leased it to tenants and went into another country. When the season for fruit drew near, he sent his servants to the tenants to get his fruit. And the tenants took his servants and beat one, killed another, and stoned another. Again, he sent other servants more than the first, and they did the same to them. Finally, he sent his son to them, saying, 'They will respect my son.' But when the tenants saw the son, they said to themselves, 'This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and have his inheritance.' They took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. When therefore the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants?" They said to him, "He will put those wretches to a miserable death and let out the vineyard to other tenants who will give him the fruits in their seasons." Jesus said to them, "Have you never read in the scriptures, 'The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes.' Therefore, I tell you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people producing its fruits. And the one who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces. And when it falls on anyone, it will crush him." When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard his parables, they perceived that he was speaking about them. And although they were seeking to arrest him, they feared the crowds because they held him to be a prophet. Here ends the reading. So, Ben, any kind of first impressions for you as we read through that text right away?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a heavy text. The condemnation of the Jews for rejecting the master, the true master of the vineyard.
Yeah, so I already went through this text beforehand. So I'm going to go through some questions that arose for me kind of at the verse by verse level. And what I've done in my practice of kind of doing biblical research is if I'm doing a close reading of a text like this, I will sit down and I'll write all these questions or I'll make these observations. The idea is just to kind of notice these things and start to look at details, especially because there can be a lot of fruit in that. So the first thing I noticed in verse 30 that caught my attention is, so we have this kind of planting in the vineyard and everything makes sense to me. And then it talks about he built a tower in it. I don't know a lot about ancient Mediterranean vineyard practices, but I'm not entirely sure what the tower is for. I don't know if that's like a guard tower. Like
yeah,
who are
like
we?
Watchtower defending from invaders or something.
People invading the vineyard. Yeah. Like, I don't know. Is that normal for vineyards? What purpose would that serve? That's something interesting that I don't know what's going on. Another big one is that I know kind of from my footnotes, if I'm paying attention to those, that there's references here to Isaiah 5, which is the passage there at the beginning of Isaiah talks about the Lord kind of planting this vineyard and he planted good grapes, but then got wild sour grapes that were no good.
Yeah. Is there a watchtower in that one?
There is. Yeah. So a question that I would have is kind of look back at that Isaiah passage. How closely is Jesus in Matthew's account? Is he kind of following some of the details there? But then I also know like these passages are kind of also, they seem to be doing some different things. So how is he interacting with that passage? How is he kind of riffing off of it? That's a really interesting comparison to make.
And so seeing what commentators might say about that parallel would
yes.
be really fruitful. That
Literally.
Would be a specific, that would be a specific thing to be looking for. How does the commentator
interact with that parallel? Because it really is just so obvious. Yeah. Another one, just kind of going a fair bit more down, is in verse 37. Finally, he sent his son to them saying, they will respect my son. So here, I mean, it's easy to read between the lines. We're talking about Jesus. And so the master of the vineyard assumes that they will respect his son. I'm curious as to what's going on there with that word respect. That seems like an interesting word choice. What does that mean? Is there some kind of like other kind of textual parallel here? They will respect my son. Like I'd expect him to say like, maybe they won't kill my son. So that seems to be presumed to be the issue is respect.
Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that before, but
yeah, right. Like this, that's just interesting. Verse 38, this one kind of, I think is interesting. What's the inheritance that the tenants are talking about? Because they see the son and they don't respect him. Spoiler alert. And they say, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him and have his inheritance. What is that inheritance? Because like, I think of an inheritance, I think of like a sum of money, but it seems like they're talking about the vineyard. But then why would they get the inheritance if they kill the son?
No, yeah, that doesn't make sense to my ears either.
Yeah, but maybe that's a thing. I don't know. Or like maybe they're really dumb. But that strikes me as kind of odd.
Right.
Maybe it's supposed to strike me. Sometimes parables are like weird on purpose.
But yeah, this is the idea that the things that we trip up on can sometimes be the things that actually, again, bear fruit in our exegesis as we think about it more deeply.
Yeah, so that's something that strikes me. Another one, this is something that I noticed when reading the Greek. In verse 40, the English says, when therefore the owner of the vineyard comes, the Greek, instead of owner of the vineyard, it has kurios tou ampelonas, so the lord of the vineyard. Now, I know kurios has a wider semantic domain. So like they'll use kurios sometimes where we would say like sir. But I think that's interesting because before he was the master of the house, we used God despotes. So now it's specifically the lord.
Oh, so it's changed here in this parable.
Yeah, so how we're referring to that character has changed to kurios, which is interesting. Yeah. I don't know kind of what to make of it.
You got to be in touch with the Greek.
Yeah, yeah. So
to bring that question up.
Something I noticed. Verse 41, so Jesus asked this question, and then it says, they said to him, he will put those wretches to a miserable death. Who's the they here? Because later on, it talks about the chief priests and the Pharisees heard his parables, verse 45. So is 41, is that referring to the chief priests and Pharisees? Are they pronouncing this judgment on themselves? Or is this like the crowds? Who exactly is the they? I'd have to look at the context better to see if I can tell what's going on there. But I noticed that because I think that's a difference. If the chief priests are saying this, or if it's the crowd saying this, and the chief priests are just kind of there watching by.
Right. That would make a difference in how you interpret. I mean, is it they're condemned by their own words now?
Right, which is a motif. Like you have that David and Nathan, you are the man. That's a thing that happens sometimes. So That's an interesting question, I think. Also in verse 41, we have this business about he'll let out the vineyard to other tenants who will give him the fruits in their seasons. I noticed there that it's plural, seasons. So there's kind of something repetitive here, year after year, however grape agriculture works. So there's a repetitiveness to this. Like I'm used to like harvest images where there's like a final harvest.
There's one season.
Right. Like you get this all the time in the Gospels. Jesus, like harvest as an eschatological image. But here, this seems to be repetitive. He wants his fruit year after year. So I wonder if then this is not quite so eschatological because there's something about that plurality that I notice. It strikes me as different.
Once again, a little odd from what we'd expect.
Yeah.
In English.
Exactly. If I'm looking at my apparatus, I notice that verse 44, and the one who falls in the stone will be broken to pieces, etc. That's omitted in a lot of manuscripts. So there's, as Veldt would say, a flag on the play here. So I'd be curious to kind of look through that, see what is the state of the textual tradition? Is this actually like pretty uncertain or what's going on there? And to also think about like, why might this text be taken out? Is there like an easy explanation for that or added in? And how does it, or does it change the reading of this passage? So that's another thing that I notice. Another one I think that's worth taking a look at is Jesus quotes, this is Psalm 118 about the stone and the builders, which is interesting because we're changing metaphors because we were talking about a vineyard. Jesus is the son of the vineyard owner and now it's a stone and it's made into the cornerstone, which I read as a reference to the resurrection. And I know this text gets quoted some other times too. I think in Paul, at the very least, gets quoted. So this seems to be a key passage. I'd be interested to go back to Psalm 118 and see if there's anything more going on in context that's relevant. So those are some of my very like detail-oriented things that I observe.
Yeah.
But then just some bigger picture questions as well that I would be interested in taking a look at. I'm intrigued by this motif of fruit and fruitfulness. This seems to be a theme throughout the scriptures. In the Isaiah 5 passage that Jesus is referring to, the fruitfulness of Israel is this important idea. And Jesus is calling back to that now in his own context. And the lack of fruitfulness then is then tied to his rejection and death. So I'd be interested in exploring that theme of fruit and fruitfulness. Like I think of fruit, I think of like good works, like specifically, like the vine discourse in John, bearing fruit to me means like do good works. But I'd be interested in exploring that motif in scripture to see, is that quite what's going on? Or is there more nuance there? Because that does seem to be something that goes throughout the scriptural narrative, this motif of fruit and fruitfulness specifically.
And how do the different commentators take that motif and interpret it?
Yeah, and then also like to put my systematician hat on for just a second, like it is interesting, like what does it mean that this fruit is offered to God? If the fruit is good works, what does it mean that they're offered to God? Like Luther talks about like, God doesn't need my good works, my neighbor does. So how is that working in this parable? Maybe it's something more than just good works, or maybe there's a particular sense in which this fruit is offered to God.
Right. Or is the fruit actually the good trees?
Maybe it's like also like praise or something.
The good trees, the person that produces the fruit is what God's after or something like that.
Yeah. It's something that if the fruit is good works, what then does it mean that they're offered to God in this? Which then is my next related big picture question is just how should we understand the various bits of the parable corresponding to the real world? So like obviously the master of the house is the father. The vineyard is Israel. That sort of thing. The son of the vineyard owner is Jesus. But how then do I read all the other bits? And to what level of detail should I read the bits? Should I read like the fence as something? The vine press is something else. The tower is something else. Does the seasons refer to something in particular? I'm sure I can imagine the church fathers probably like had a field day with like identifying all the various elements with other things.
Right.
But yeah, so like what's the best way to go about that? That's a question I have. The last one would just be, this is a text that seems to me is very focused on Israel and Israel's accepting and rejecting the Messiah, and especially her leaders, it seems to be, because the chief priests get that this is about them, in particular the leaders. So then where and how does the church and Gentiles fit into this? I don't know if that question is being asked yet, because you have this business of the vineyard being let out to other tenants. Is that talking about the church? But then it's not as if Israel is rejected. That's something that Paul talks about in like Romans 8 through 11. So how should we understand that? How does the church and Gentiles fit into this? Because I think there could be some bad ways of doing that.
So, and yeah, what other scripture passages do you connect this as parallel to, like the shepherd passages in Ezekiel? Is it just at the shepherds of Israel?
Yeah, exactly. So those are some questions that arose for me. And so then if I were to continue in doing some research on this passage, when I go to my commentaries, when I search through journal databases, etc., I'm looking for some answers to these questions that might even change like what words I put in like the search bar. So I'm interested in this idea of fruit and fruitfulness. So I might also look at, say, encyclopedia resources like Anchor Bible Dictionary is one. One of my favorites, I don't know if you've ever used this one before. It's the New Dictionary of Biblical Theology, edited by T. Desmond Alexander. And it's got just all these articles on kind of biblical themes, and it talks about how these themes get developed across the scriptures. It's a very kind of biblical theology.
I hadn't heard of that before.
Yeah, no, it's really good. So I would love to see, do they have an article on fruit or kind of other similar resources?
So you're proposing looking for answers outside of a commentary even. This is just general.
Yeah, well, and I think asking these questions then helps you to figure out where to look. So like we're asking questions about fruit. So that then drives what I look for. Maybe I look for articles about that. I noted a thing about kurios. So maybe I want to go look at some like theological dictionaries to see about kind of usages of that. And if that's something that's noted as well. Yeah, so I think these questions then help you to broaden your research so you don't just read commentary after commentary. I've observed that sometimes I find other resources are actually more helpful. Commentaries, they have to get through so much, so they just summarize all this stuff. I found that sometimes articles, monographs, etc., can actually be more helpful, in especially if you want to dig really deep into a passage and understand it. Commentaries kind of just summarize what other people are saying sometimes.
That's a great point.
Yeah. So that's what we've got for today. I hope you all found this helpful, and best of luck in studying the scriptures in this way.
Thanks, Kendall.
If you enjoyed Back to the Sources, be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Facebook so that you don't miss a single episode. This podcast is brought to you by the Hasse Library on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The Hasse Library, inspiring theological discovery.